Freddie Mercury and Oscar Wilde had one big thing in common. Both knew how to play to a crowd. Well, that and the fact that both ended up dying relatively young. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss a pair of movies, Bohemian Rhapsody and The Happy Prince, that feature in the first Mercury, the late lead singer of the rock group Queen, and in the second, Wilde, the 19th century Irish-born playwright and poet. We'll also talk about Tea with the Dames, a documentary that explores the lives and careers of four great British actresses. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs. And not only the programs, but the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you those programs. So here's a very large thank you to you, the listener, in listener-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that features three relatively intelligent individuals who have at least one big thing in common. We love movies. That shared love gets us through those weeks when there is little playing in local theaters worth seeing. Lucky for us, though, last week was a bit better than usual. We were able to rock out to the music of the British rock group Queen, thanks to Bohemian Rhapsody, Bryan Singer's study of Queen's lead singer, the late Freddie Mercury. Thanks to The Happy Prince, which Rupert Everett not only wrote and directed but also stars in, we were able to explore the final years and precipitous fall from grace of the Irish-born poet and playwright Oscar Wilde. And thanks to the Roger Michell-directed documentary Tea with the Dames, we were able to hear tales from four of Britain's greatest thespians. Let's begin with a study of the man who promised that he would rock us. If you're not familiar with the song that Bryan Singer's movie takes its title from, just think of the Mike Myers 1992 comedy Wayne's World and the scene where Wayne, Garth, and his buddies do some headbanging in a car. Yep, that's the same tune by the same group, the British rock group Queen. Centering on Queen's lead singer Freddie Mercury, Singer's film picks up at the point when Mercury joined guitarist Brian May and drummer Roger Taylor, later to be joined by bassist John Deacon, and began making music. It continues over the next several years, taking the obligatory dramatic Hollywood leaps into fantasy. While portraying the group's rise to fame, the film focuses on Mercury's personal mercurial odyssey, which included his embrace of his sexual orientation, he was, of course, gay, and the realization that he had contracted AIDS, which led to his death in 1991 at the age of 45. Hardly a perfect film, Bohemian Rhapsody, if anything, sanitizes Mercury's wild escapades both as a rock star and as a gay man in the 1980s. Yet it has two distinct qualities: the riveting performance of Rami Mr. Robot Malek as Mercury, and the music of Queen itself, which is a highlight of the movie's crowning climactic sequence, its 20-minute appearance at the 1985 Live Aid concert.
And I, like anybody, love Queen. I think they're one of those bands that everybody likes, because like the Beatles, they have so many different styles that they kind of dabbled in, that there's got to be some period
and
of Queen's
music that
you like.
And so many songs that get in your head and like an earworm.
Absolutely.
And won't let go.
And, you know, obviously you have to like Queen because, to quote 30 Rock, I have two ears and a heart, don't I? I mean, they're just one of those undeniable bands. And so I was excited to see Bohemian Rhapsody because these songs are iconic. Freddie Mercury is great. I mean, I dressed up as Freddie Mercury for Halloween a few years ago.
Noticed.
So I'm a big fan. And, you know, the problem with movies like this, with musical biopics, and watching this movie, Bohemian Rhapsody, is like playing musical biopic bingo. The problem with these movies is that most bands, even great ones like Queen, don't really have an inherently interesting story because we're watching as the history of the band kind of unfolds, and they've got actors that really look the part, although there's just always that kind of idea that it's just like dudes in really bad wigs. You never kind of rise above that. You never quite believe them as characters because they're just there to look like the original guys. And it's also really difficult, I think, to portray the actual process of writing, whether it be songwriting or writing a novel. Movies have always had a hard time with this, and this film is no exception because, you know, there's the moment where they're having a fight in the recording studio, and then John Deacon pulls out his bass. He pulls out his bass, and he starts doing the riff for Another One Bites the Dust, and they go, hang on a minute, that's a pretty good riff. And you're like, okay, give me a break. I mean, there are segments of Bohemian Rhapsody that play out almost like that parody movie Walk Hard with John C. Reilly. I mean, like that. So you've got all of the signposts. You've got the manager who maybe doesn't have the band's best interest in mind. You've got the hangers-on that maybe don't have the band's best interest in mind. You've got them having a falling out, and then you have to have the reconciliation right before the big show.
Right.
You've got the record executive who doesn't understand the experimentation of the title song Bohemian Rhapsody, played by Mike Myers, funnily enough. He just doesn't get it, but then he's proven wrong when the song is a big hit. And then you've got the personal demons that get out of control and then have to be reined back in again right before the big show. And if you're a Queen fan, even a passing Queen fan, you're going to recognize that most of the stuff in this movie either didn't happen or happened completely out of order as the film portrays it. Like at one point, they're performing the song Fat Bottom Girls years before that song was ever written. So I had a little problem like that all through it. Freddie Mercury is such an interesting figure, not just as a musician and a performer, but as a cultural icon and as a gay man in the 80s. And they talk about it after he is diagnosed with AIDS. He specifically says, you know, I don't want to be a poster boy for a disease. I don't want your sympathy. I just want to keep doing what I'm doing. And I wish the movie had the same kind of resolve. I think that he deserves a better biopic than this film. And I don't know if it's because they sanded down all of the edges to make it into a PG-13 film. I mean, it's like a cartoon. It's offensive in certain places where you think, like, they're not even trying to deal with this in a serious way, or because of all of the production problems that went on. I mean, I think
Bryan Singer was fired at one point.
He was fired at one point because he stopped showing up, and should he have even been hired in the first place? And then the cinematographer had to step in for a few days, and then they brought in Dexter Fletcher to finish it, but just Singer has the credit. So I don't know what happened here to make this film. It doesn't feel nearly as messy as I expected, considering the production problems, but it's not very good either. I mean, it does feel like a dress-up kind of movie, even though Rami Malek is such a perfect casting choice for Freddie Mercury.
I can't imagine it.
Because
that would have been a parody throughout the entire film.
I think so. And Rami Malek throws himself into an impossible role, frankly, because no one will ever fill the shoes of Freddie Mercury. I mean, maybe the greatest male rock vocalist of all time. At least I think so. So, I mean, there are moments where you see him and you go, wow, he is pulling off a seemingly impossible feat. I just wish the movie around him were up to his standard because it's just... It feels like one of those old VH1, you know, made for TV band films with just a slightly higher budget. At least the music is great.
Okay, that's where I would like to focus because you are the music critic. Yep. And so, as you pointed out, everyone knows these songs. I mean, and so I think the iconic nature of the music and the way, even though it's a little hokey in spots.
A
little more than hokey in spots.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what, in the end, drives Bohemian Rhapsody as a film. The music, and we look forward to seeing, oh, when's our favorite song going to be portrayed and so forth and so on. And so I think that, again, we've said this a couple of times in the past few weeks, which is unusual for us because we mentioned it when we talked about A Star is Born. I would suggest seeing it in Dolby sound.
Mm-hmm. I saw it in IMAX, yeah.
And so why not if you have that opportunity? Nathan, I don't know what you do with something. I mean, I was a little bit more concerned about the fact that they just sort of glossed over some of the discrimination, although we see it at the beginning, regarding his ethnicity.
Yeah.
And we have these sort of stock parental figures, and the sister, I don't even know why she was in there exactly, because I think that there could have been some opportunities to explore various aspects of that. And then his relationship with his long-term love. I don't know. Maybe you have a better idea. How truthful was that in terms of his course of dealing
with her? He ended up leaving his house to her and a lot of his money.
They were very close for pretty much his entire life after he came out. And many songs that are some of their biggest hits are supposedly written about her.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah. So that was a legit piece of it, whether it was portrayed in a little bit sappy fashion. And so I think that's our ongoing critique. That this was really, in many ways, Bohemian Rhapsody as a film, as an exploration of this individual, was a missed opportunity to drill deeper on some aspects of his life that, you know, our curiosity is piqued by seeing happened here.
I think that, if nothing else, Bryan Singer's Bohemian Rhapsody is worth seeing simply because it made me all the way through do two things. The Live Aid concert was filmed, so you can go on YouTube and you can see their 20-minute performance. It is amazing. I saw it before seeing Bohemian Rhapsody, and I saw it afterwards. And the movie doesn't do that justice. I'm sorry. It keeps cutting to the crowd. And it's like, I don't care about the crowd. I don't care about seeing some Yahoo out there pantomiming, you know, trying to be Freddie Mercury. I want to see Rami Malek be Freddie Mercury. And then I wanted to see the real Freddie Mercury. So that's the one thing. The second thing is, this makes me beg someone to do a documentary about this. We know all that footage is there. Imagine what they could do with a Queen documentary.
I mean, you could do an entire segment, and they talk about it briefly, but the music video that they did in Drag, which I think was for I Want to Break Free, wasn't it? And the pushback against that, the fact that MTV refused to air it, and Rami Malek says it in the film where he says, well,
it wasn't even my idea.
Yeah, it wasn't my idea, but I'm the one that's basically being blamed for the quote-unquote salacious nature of this. There's so much interesting stuff going on in the life of Freddie Mercury, and less so in the life of Queen, I think. Mm-hmm. The segments that work best for me in Bohemian Rhapsody are the scenes in the recording studio where you see them making the titular song, where you see them experimenting with putting weird percussion instruments inside of a piano and dropping coins onto a bongo drum and things like that. And it reminded me of, I think, one of the best depictions of how music is actually made, a recent film called Love and Mercy, which was about the making of the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album. Right. And I think that got you in the headspace of a very difficult subject.
And I was going to say, if you're able to get in the headspace of Brian Wilson, you have achieved something phenomenal.
And this movie doesn't get us into the headspace of Freddie Mercury. Yeah. And I don't know if it really even wanted to. And
I think you're right. You know, I do not think
Brian
was
May
its intention.
And Roger Taylor were both co-executive producers of this, so they had some say in what was going on. But to go back to my point about a documentary, they're still alive, as is John Deacon.
Right.
So imagine if you could see everything through their eyes and then see, it would be an amazing documentary.
If nothing else, I mean, I know that you can't make a movie like this without those guys' permission to use the music, and so therefore you get something of a sanitized feel on a lot of things.
Right.
I had the same problem with Straight Outta Compton, where the surviving people are producers, so therefore are portrayed in a quite saintly manner when they were not. So at least we have the music, though, and Rami Malek. I mean, there are certain shots in this movie where he looks eerily like Freddie Mercury, especially after he gets that stash.
Absolutely, yes.
He rocks that stash.
And that was Bohemian Rhapsody. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Happy Prince and Tea with the Dames. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbin, and I discussed Bohemian Rhapsody. Let's now move to another study of a tortured artistic soul, The Happy Prince, and a quartet of far happier stage and screen stars in the documentary Tea with the Dames. Let's begin with a bit of Ernest. Long before he died in 1900 at the age of 46, virtually penniless and abandoned by most of his former friends and fans, Oscar Wilde had been the toast of London's literary world, coasting along on such stage plays as The Importance of Being Earnest and Lady Windermere's Fan. Wilde was admired for his comic wit and his ability to skewer the social customs of the British upper classes, making the very targets of his poison pen laugh at themselves. But Wilde was gay at a time when it was illegal, and that, along with his penchant for not just pushing but smashing social norms, led to his eventual downfall, a 2-year term in jail, the loss of his family and fortune, and exile on the continent, where ultimately he died in a Paris apartment lined, so the legend goes, with bad wallpaper. The British actor Rupert Everett, who himself is openly gay, wrote, directed, and stars in The Happy Prince, an ironic title taken from one of Wilde's short stories, and which serves as the film's main narrative arc. And while the production is well made, the costumes and sets authentic, and Everett's makeup astounding, the film itself feels like a vanity project, one devoted to a man who himself admits that he is his own worst enemy. I don't remember the exact quote, but Everett has Wilde ask something like, "Why do I ride toward ruin? Whatever is the fascination?" Everett's own performance is bravura, but I wish as a filmmaker he'd spent more time answering that particular question.
In fairness, Rupert Everett, this is his first film, and he has starred in a number of films or appeared in a number of films, but he himself is also a stage actor to some extent. And as a result, I think that he didn't really know exactly what to do with various scenes. The segues between scenes are sometimes a little rough and so forth. So The Happy Prince does maybe suffer from some of the inexperience as a filmmaker that Rupert Everett unfortunately demonstrates here repeatedly. It's his performance, however, I think as Oscar Wilde, that carries this film. And I really appreciated the fact that the film is titled after one of his short stories. And the short story is presented in part, as you pointed out, Dan, it's the arc of the film. And we sort of hear his telling this short story, or the Rupert Everett, Oscar Wilde characters telling this story to various audiences over time, including
and
his own sons.
Sons, yeah.
So I thought that that was a nice touch. I thought that was a nice framing device. The problem is, as you point out, for audiences who are not familiar with Oscar Wilde's work, we may get a sense of who he is, but we don't get a sense of what contributions he made to literature. And we keep seeing scenes of Rupert Everett's Oscar Wilde talking about, oh, I was famous and I did this. But I think there needed to be a little more focus on his earlier life. And as Nathan had pointed out in a previous segment, it's hard to show people writing. So how do you deal with that? But they sort of ignored that fact completely and focused a lot more on his personal life, which may have been of greater interest to Rupert Everett. I don't know.
And let's say this about Rupert Everett. I think the one thing that The Happy Prince, an ironic title if I ever heard one, one thing that recommends this film to people is it's going to win an Oscar for Best Makeup. Rupert Everett is a very good-looking man, and you cannot even recognize him under the ton of makeup that they have on him to make him look like an aging Oscar Wilde, you know, a guy who'd seen his better days.
And I don't know, but Colin Firth, as his friend, is not going to get any sort of Academy Award for the mustache that they sort of plop on his lower face.
But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, he's an Academy Award winner. Tom Wilkinson has a small part as an Academy Award winner. Emily Watson, who has the unfortunate role as his wife, Constance, has been nominated for Academy Awards. So he's surrounded himself with talent. But, you know, there's just something about, as you pointed out, you don't get a sense for who Oscar Wilde necessarily was, except in the sense of his self-destructive nature, particularly in the latter years of his life. And you don't get to know who he was as a person and what drove him. It's like a bad masterpiece theater production that is for the literati and not for a general audience.
You mentioned some of the award-winning actors in this film. I think that Colin Morgan, who plays Lord Alfred Bosie Douglas, who was the love of Oscar Wilde's life,
the antagonist.
Right. I appreciated his performance throughout because Bosie was this spoiled little snot, but it was the type of thing that, you know, he was the object of Wilde's desires. And I thought they did a nice job dealing with that obsession and how it manifests itself and so forth. So I think that people who are interested in his work might be intrigued by getting a little bit more of the backstory. As you mentioned, there are some good performances. You know, it doesn't really play off of Dublin or London in any way, because most of it is filmed in other locales, in France, for example. So I think if you are intrigued by Oscar Wilde, you would appreciate this film.
Yeah, so The Happy Prince is a movie that Tony Flynn might recommend. So let's close with Tea with the Dames. The four women featured in Roger Michell's documentary are all in their 80s. Joan Plowright is 89, while Eileen Atkins is 84, and Maggie Smith and Judi Dench are both 83. All are deemed with the title of dames, the women's equivalent to knighthood, and their individual rewards for their respective work in the arts, both on stage and in film. All longtime friends, they've gathered annually over the years to chat and reminisce, and the only difference this time is that filmmaker Michelle, perhaps best known for having directed the 1999 Hugh Grant, Julia Roberts romantic comedy Notting Hill, captured their meeting on camera. Tea with the Dames may not captivate everyone, but it should prove interesting to those with some sense of British acting history and to anyone amused by the occasional bits of British showbiz gossip. If nothing else, seeing snippets of these actresses' many roles over the years, both on screen and on stage, is rewarding all by itself.
Yeah, this almost feels more like an extended DVD feature of some kind. I don't know how much interest it'll have outside of theater fans or fans of these actresses. And you're right, the archival clips you see, especially of the theatrical productions that they did that were probably filmed for the BBC or something, those are really great. But, you know, these four women, they just have so much charm and they're so effortlessly funny that I kind of liked having tea with them, although they don't really have much tea in it.
No, they drink champagne.
Yeah.
But, you know, they share stories about their individual processes. They talk about the roles that they were too afraid to take, like Cleopatra, for instance. None of them thought they were pretty enough to be Cleopatra. They talk about the actual feeling of becoming a dame. They talk about some of the difficult actors and directors that they've worked with.
Including Plowright's husband, Laurence Olivier.
Yes, they talk about him, and we see some unfortunate footage of him as Othello. That wouldn't fly today, would it? But yeah, it made me realize this movie, Tea with the Dames. I mean, I don't think you need to rush out and see it necessarily, but it made me realize that I'd love to see more documentaries like this. Like I was thinking, you mentioned Notting Hill.
Right.
I think it'd be interesting to see the same kind of thing with like the romantic comedy leads from the 80s and 90s, like Julia Roberts and Meg Ryan and Andy McDowell talking about what it was like to be pigeonholed in those roles in that era. Or even like some of the surviving people from the new Hollywood trend. If you could get Jack Nicholson and Donald Sutherland in a room and talk about what it was like to be there. I like this format. It's kind of like that Dinner for Five show they used to have on IFC or whatever.
Right.
But
right.
I mean, it's not really a movie, but it's interesting enough.
But I think that everyone is going to be familiar with either from Harry Potter or from Downton Abbey or, you know, James Bond.
Yeah.
Best Marigold Exotic.
Those movies.
Right. You're going to be familiar with these people. I appreciated getting to know some things about their theater careers because it's interspersed with some personal things, but it's not really the focal point of what we're doing here. And I did like the banter among the group, and I also appreciated the archival footage. So if you happen upon it, go and see it.
That's right.
Have some tea.
And that and that was Tea with the Dames, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Bohemian Rhapsody and The Happy Prince. Let's thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, well, we have to leave you with a quip by Oscar Wilde. I am so clever that sometimes I don't understand a single word of what I am saying. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.